The following program brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice. All economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal, and any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any persons for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax. Penalties that may be imposed on such persons and each listener should seek advice from their tax advisor or legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice, and nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Had a good one today. We're going to be talking about inheritances from a historical perspective, and then also how do baby boomers look at inheritance differently than their parents did. And then one of my colleagues is going to call in and tell a real-life story about an income inheritance that happened with someone very close to him. I can't wait for all that. First of all, let's do a little news of the week brought to you by Class 101. You can check them out at myclass101.com. They'll help you with that necessary headache of filling out that FAFSA form as my son approaches what his junior year next year. We'll be doing that before you know it. All right, let's talk about this. You know I'm very passionate about being a paternalistic employer, having people do things for themselves that they otherwise won't do when it comes to retirement planning. I found this interesting. In Australia, employers are required to contribute an amount equal to 9.5% of an employee's pay. Okay, wages and bonuses are not, and not overtime pay. They don't get counted into a retirement account that's owned and managed by the employee. That's the Australian system. And since it's been in place in 1992, it's going to require an increase by the time of 2021 of 10 to 10%. So my point here is that, you know, you currently pay in as an employer, you know, 7.25% between Medicare and Social Security. That's kind of what this is. It's kind of paying into the system. I thought that was pretty interesting stuff. And I've been a big proponent of telling people, hey, auto-enroll, auto-escalate. People are less apt to opt out than opt in. I see it all the time. When someone's hired at the local school system, let's say, and there's a 2 or 3% match, guess what they do? They put in 2 or 3%. 30 years later, they're still putting 2 or 3% in because there's not an auto escalator built in. There is auto enroll, but no auto escalators. Big, big, big deal. Otherwise, we're all going to be paying for it because the people currently working are not going to have enough money. Outstanding debt, costly college, as they say. Student loan debt is now $1.31 trillion as of the end of December 2016. 11.2% of student debt is at least 90 days delinquent or is in default as of the end of 2016. Delinquent calculations understates the delinquency rate, that are now in deferment as well. So here's the deal. What I'm going to say next is going to, I think, illustrate this very, very well. Number one, the nation's unemployment rate was 4.8% as of January 2017. However, adults ages 25 and up with at least a bachelor's degree from college, just 2.5%. The lowest national unemployment rate in U.S. history was 2.5% back in June of 1953. The unfortunate part of this $1.3 trillion in debt is not all of them. In fact, many of them do not have a completed degree, which is kind of a shame. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little about inheritances. How do baby boomers look at inheritance? How do their parents look at inheritances? And the idea of having an income inheritance versus just a big cash inheritance. We'll be right back, folks. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Appreciate you hanging out with us. You know, I just finished teaching a Rejuvenate Your Retirement course over at Ivy Tech. Had a great time. We're going to follow it up again next week. Hopefully, a few of you are now listening to the show, fans of the show. But next week in our class, we're going to be talking about estate planning, and we're going to talk about inheritances and different ways to look at inheritances. And I'll tell you that the Bob Hope generation, or the children of the Depression that we called them, you know, for them, it was all about leaving money. In fact, it was probably because they didn't have any growing up. So they thought, I want to leave my kids off better than I was, so therefore I want to leave money. In fact, my grandma, I can tell you, she would have rather have eaten dog food than to have spent that $10,000 in the bank because she wanted that money. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. What do you think about this idea of leaving an income inheritance? You know, I mentioned before, you get a big cash inheritance. That would be fantastic. And then maybe you pay your house off, you buy a car, you put some kids through school, and then at the end of the day, you know, it's gone and you have a very faint memory of really what that money did for you. But the idea of leaving an income inheritance where you have a constant reminder, and if you're one of these people who say, I'm going to haunt you from the grave, maybe this is a way you can do it as well. I wanted to have one of my colleagues come on who has had this real life experience happen in his world of the idea of leaving an income inheritance and what it meant for the family. So now joining me is my buddy. We're going to have him talk about this. Dave, when we talk about leaving an income inheritance, I think the idea here is to create a legacy, a memory. It's not just about the money. The story that you have, the story that you've shared with me more than once is great. So welcome to the show, Dave. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to sharing this idea with all your listeners.
Well, go right ahead, because I think you can take it from here and really do a good job of talking about this family and then how the inheritance came, and then after they came back and discussed this many, you know, three years later, what it really meant to them.
Yeah, you bet. You know, this all started with kind of a hypothetical question. And, you know, we think about the memories we have with our parents and our grandparents and what it was like growing up and the special place that, you know, we all have for them. And the question I posed to this family was, what if today, on your way home, when you go to check your mailbox before you pull into the garage, how do you do it? In the stack of all the mail that you get, there is an envelope, and in that envelope, you open it up, and there's a check. And the check is in there because of something that your grandmother or your grandfather or your great-grandmother or your great-grandfather did years and years ago. Do you think you would remember your grandparent any differently?
I think so.
You think you'd have more memories, right? You think you'd be able to recall experiences that you had that maybe were filed away in a memory that you don't access that often. Do you think it would remind you of some of the lessons and the traditions that they shared that you in turn could share with your own family? And so that question David posed to this family really got the wheels turning about what that would mean. I think they took that to heart, and they pictured themselves in that situation, and they wanted to explore that further. And so at the end of the day, this family decided that for a portion of their assets that they were going to leave as part of their estate plan, that they wanted to carve off a portion to create this family inheritance, this income inheritance idea. And what was unique about in this situation is the grandmother at the time that started to do all the planning decided that she wanted to keep it somewhat of a secret. This was between her and her financial advisor as they went through and doing this. And when she set this up, none of the other kids, there were three kids involved here, two daughters and a son, and these are adult children. They were not aware of what mom was doing behind the scenes. And so what happened, this was back in 2010, mom had went ahead and implemented this strategy. And after she got it up and running and implemented, she sat down and put pen to paper, if you will, on a family love letter and expressed in writing to her kids why she did this, the thought behind it, the intent, the expectations going forward that her kids, her kids' kids, and so on, use this as a reminder of the legacy and the love that she is the matriarch of the family have. Mm-hmm. And so this letter goes in the file, right, never to be seen or heard of again until 2013. And that's when mom passed away. So now, fast forward 2013, these three kids now all come in. They're sitting down with the financial advisor. And the financial advisor is going through all the assets and making sense of everything that's happening right now and says, at this particular time, your mother had asked that I share this letter with you.
Wow.
He reaches into the file, David, hands the letter to all the kids. They read it, and you can imagine this is a note from the grave, right? The emotions are raw. They're fresh. They just got done burying their mother. They're going through everything, and here comes this letter that was clear with the, you know, the intent and the extra thought and planning that went into it. And I think that was a testimony right there that, let's face it, does it take a lot of thought and effort to just put a beneficiary down as 100% lump sum?
No,
not really, right? We just all default to doing this. So this does take some effort on everybody's part. So I think that the kids appreciated that. And also it was another connection to their mother, right, that they weren't expecting. So now, here we are, that was 2013. The kids now inherit equal shares of their income inheritance. And we fast forward then to September of last year, September of 2016. And we're having a discussion with this family, right? 3 years now after mom's gone, seeing really what's happened in their lives, what's transpired, how is this income inheritance played out and what impact it had. And the feedback and the stories we got, David, were just the most compelling, moving, heart-touching stuff that you could ever imagine. So to give an example, the daughter, and this daughter lived in New Jersey, and so she was calling in to share her experience, said that, you know, as we were receiving these checks, this income inheritance was designed to come on a quarterly distribution. And so as we got these checks, we knew because of the letter that mom had expressly stated that she wanted us to do something with the money. Don't just, you know, file it away or put it in a bank account.
Or pay bills, you know, with it, yeah.
Exactly. Do something special with it in memory of her. So her sister and her brother talked about this. And I said, you know, what are some of the things that we hold near and dear to our heart about mom? And they all immediately went back, like many of us would, to holidays, right? The traditions that we have with families around our holidays. And in this particular case, it was around Thanksgiving. And their mother happened to be the biggest fanatic for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And so they all called. Memories of children growing up that it was on the TV, and from beginning to end, mom was watching this. And so every year, this was part of their Thanksgiving Day tradition. Well, nobody in the family had ever been to New York City to see it in person. So what do you think they did?
They saved up the checks, and they went to New York City, to the Big Apple. Here we go, everybody.
You nailed it. I mean, how cool is that? So they save up enough of the checks to take the whole family to New York City on Thanksgiving Day to be there front and center for the whole parade. And they did this because of what mom put together. And so she shared that story. She went on to share a story about a particular charity that her mother was incredibly passionate about. And so they used some of the checks to continue to stay involved with that charity. And they used that as an opportunity to have discussions with their own kids about the importance of philanthropy and being involved. So it's just created all this new avenues and ways to keep their mother's legacy alive and perpetuate really the values that are most important as they pass these down. And so as we were wrapping it up, the call here, the question came back to Gail and said, Gail, you know, this is fantastic. Do you mind if you share with us, what did you guys do with the lump sum money? And in the letter,
the rest of the money. So they had the income side, but they also got some lump sum too.
Exactly right. And the letter, which obviously you can't see, but the letter stated that the majority of the assets were still passing lump sum. It was just this piece had been carved out. So hence the question: what did you guys do with the lump sum money? And on the line, then as we're listening, comes an awkward silence. And so we're all wondering, okay, is it because she's too embarrassed? Because, you know, she's a statistic because they spent it all. And in this case, it wasn't that way. What happened was she said, you know, I really don't know. And I think if you're an individual right now thinking about wealth transfer strategies and your whole life savings that you've accumulated through hard work and good decisions and good planning, and you leave that to your kids, and 3 years after you're gone, your children, adult children, responsible children in this case, can't even tell you what happened to it. Yet all of these quarterly checks that they've received has now created a new story, a new memory, a new experience. There's photos to memorialize it. There was just a total disparity in the emotional significance between how this family reacted to the inheritance piece that came as an income as opposed to the lump sum money. So it was really eye-opening as you see this go down through the family and the impact that it had.
And Dave, when we talk about an income inheritance, I think it's neat to talk about how it can be multi-generational, not just to the, you know, daughter and her two siblings, but then how the grandkids can get involved in this action too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I forgot to mention, in the structure of this, while the kids were the ones receiving it now, the way the mother, the matriarch set it up is that after her kids are gone and it goes down then to her grandkids, the grandkids are all guaranteed to continue to receive this income inheritance. And in this particular example, there was actually a great-grandson that was living at the time that this was structured. So there is literally will be four generations of guaranteed lifetime income inheritance because of the planning that she did. If you think about this, there's going to be income guaranteed potentially to go into a next century, into the next century. And how cool is that?
That's unbelievable. Dave is our guest, good colleague of mine, good friend for many, many years. And when he told me the story of a real-life situation, I thought, I got to have him on to tell it because I can't tell it the way that he tells it because he was there. Dave, let's talk real quick before I let you go. A lot of people might think, okay, we're talking about an elaborate trust or we're talking about a lot of money to set this stuff up. That's not the case at all, is it?
No, it really isn't. And that's the beauty of this letter that she put together, you know, really acted as a substitute to the trust. She didn't want to get an additional cost involved. Mm-hmm. And so the letter really served as a poor man's trust. But in this case, we were talking about a couple $100,000. This isn't multiple millions that you have to be able to do this. So really, in our experience, Dave, what we've seen is $100,000 that you want to designate as a minimum really is what's needed to make this plan have some teeth and work through multiple generations. So there's a lot of flexibility for families to figure out what's the appropriate mix.
If you'd like to learn more about how to leave an income inheritance, we're going to have a legacy, Leaving a Legacy Town Hall meeting in September, I believe, Dave, and you're going to be there to help us out with that. But if people want to know more about it before that, you know, we have been trained in setting these up as well. So just give us a call or contact us through our website, cfci.us. And we'll make sure you set up that income inheritance properly so that you can also be in the memories of your kids, your grandkids, your great-grandkids for decades and, like Dave said, even into the next century. Hey, Dave, I know you're busy. I know you have a meeting coming up. I appreciate you taking the time. It's been fabulous, and I'm sure we'll have you on again in the fall as we kick off this Legacy Town Hall meeting that you'll be helping us out with in September.
Thanks, Dave.
Appreciate it. We're going to be back, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. That was great. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks, Dave, my buddy, calling in, helping us understand what it means to a family to have created an income inheritance. You know, a lot of this is part of the proper estate plan, right? I mean, when you set up your accounts, you have accounts that are direct transfer, those that have accounts such as joint with rights of survivorship, and that means when I die, if that account's set up with my wife, Misty, it goes to her. It does not matter what my will says. It doesn't matter what a trust says. If the account's titled that way, that's where it goes. Beneficiary planning, a lot of these annuities, life insurance, IRAs, 401ks, it's all driven by your beneficiary form. And the tools that are used to help set up these guaranteed lifetime income streams, like Dave mentioned in the inheritance idea, is using an annuity chassis. So he called it a poor man's trust. It's basically where you can predetermine how you want these things to happen, and then you can kind of control from the grave. But remember, this isn't about thinking, okay, my son, my daughter's going to just, you know what, all the money away. But it's a token of love. It's a token of the family legacy, the memories, and the love letter idea. My gosh, I mean, that is so powerful. So you're going to hear me talking more about this as time goes on. But it's so important to just be part of your beneficiary planning, your estate planning. Because, yeah, you need a will. You might need a trust. You're going to need a power of attorney. You're going to need an appointment of a health care representative. You're going to need a living will, right? I mean, these are all the main pieces to a good estate plan. You know, the will is simply the instruction manual to the courts that says, hey, when I die, anything that's in my name individually, this is where I want it to go. You have an executor, someone that's going to run that for you. That goes through the, quote, probate process. It's not that big of a deal. But a lot of people will be able to can leave things directly through a direct transfer, and that's what I'm talking about with how to properly title accounts. Pay on death with POD, transfer on death, TOD. You know, you can practically transfer anything by an account designation without it going through the will, without it going through probate. That is the necessities of putting a good estate plan together and a potential income inheritance. You know, you can even do automobiles that way. You can do real estate. I remember back in the old days, people would sign their titles to their car, stick it in the top drawer, and then they say, if I die, go take it down and re-register it in your name. You don't have to do that anymore. You can make it a transfer on death right on the title. When you go down to the BMV, add TOD. Maybe you want your home to transfer on death to someone. Make it a TOD. Simple. Cost a few bucks over at the title company. They'll record it, and away you go. There's so many easier ways to do things than people make it very complicated. Now, there's reasons you may not want to do it that way. Certainly, you should consult with a legal professional before you make those important legal decisions, those lifelong decisions, legacy decisions for sure. But this is what it's all about. This is what it's all about. I actually have a neat story that I talk about in the classes that we teach. We just are wrapping up the Rejuvenate Your Retirement over at Ivy Tech. Hope everyone had a great time, by the way. I appreciate that. It's fun to teach. I love to teach. In fact, many of you that know me know that I wanted to be a math teacher and a football coach, right? Because I love coaching football. I was pretty good at math and thought, why not? Well, my coach in high school at the time, Ralph Haynes over at Edgewood, he said, don't do that. Of course, I'm like, why not? He said, well, don't do that because, number one, you're always stressed out about your job. He said, you're not going to make that much money. He said, go do something that you really love and that you can still help people and coach people and that you can make a little more money at. And that's what I did, and that's really how I ended up where I am today. But I still love teaching, and it's even more enjoyable when the people getting taught the material are absorbing it, enjoying it, and in fact, they even clapped at the end of the class. And I thought, that was pretty cool. No one really claps at the end of class. I can guarantee my son, who's coming out of geometry, is not clapping for his teacher after they just learned whatever they learned in geometry. I don't even remember what it is anymore. But I like to run around with this story. In 1994, there was an article written in the New York Times, and it was about a school teacher who passed away. She'd been married to her husband, the Friedmans, they were called, for 24 years. And Mr. Friedman never doubted that he was entitled to the nearly $1 million lump sum payment from the New York Teachers Retirement System, because when they would get the annual notices, it would say, you know, no beneficiary listed. So naturally, as her spouse, he thought, well, he's going to be the beneficiary. And that's usually the case. The problem is, after Annie, she was a former school principal, passed away, the state system found an old beneficiary form that had been filled out 1 year before the couple met on a blind date. Guess what? The beneficiary form had Annie's mother, her brother, and her sister, Virginia, all listed as equal beneficiaries. Well, Annie's mom and brother had predeceased, but Virginia was still living. Guess who got all the money? Virginia got all the money because the beneficiary form trumps everything. So Mr. Friedman said, and she won't give me a cent of it. So they went all the way to the Manhattan Supreme Court, and guess what? The Supreme Court said, sorry, Charlie, the money's going to Virginia. That's why it's so important to pay attention to these things, to pay attention to how your accounts are titled, to pay attention to your beneficiary forms, to pay attention to the wording in your will. Has it been updated? I think it's important that you have a good, durable power of attorney so people can act for you financially if you choose not to or you just can't. A healthcare representative, someone that can make healthcare decisions for you. I always tell people, have a healthcare rep on your adult children. You have a 23-year-old going to IU, and they are in the hospital for some reason, and you're having trouble accessing the information because, yeah, I'm the mom, but it's still part of the whole HIPAA rules and regulations. We had a friend of mine who had a son hit by a car in California, almost killed him, and he could not get the information that he wanted or needed from Indiana because he did not have a healthcare power of attorney in place for his adult children. Now, some people will say, well, they're married, so his spouse has it. Yeah, that's fine. But you can have multiple people that can make healthcare decisions or at least get information from the physicians or from the hospitals. It doesn't have to just be one. But that's so important to have those basic documents in place. And I always tell people, listen, when you do estate planning, don't think of it of, okay, I'm 47 now. When I'm 87, no. Think about it, okay, over the next 5 years, if something would happen to Misty and I, what would I want to occur? Who would I want to help raise my son? Who would I want to handle the money? Who would I want to do this or that? And then 5 years go by, and now my son's in college, and you know my dad now is 5 years older, and I say, you know, for the next five years, you know what? I think I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do that, or now this person's going to take care of the money. I'll tell you, I just did all this, and it's been about 5 years since we updated it. Since then, my father-in-law has came down with dementia. He's home-ridden. I mean, he can't do anything for himself, and he was listed as one of the many backups for our power of attorney and such. So, you know, those are the reasons you update them. You get married, you get divorced, you have kids, you have grandkids, whatever. That's a good time to really take a step back and look at your documents, look at things. And I tell you, you can't do it enough. And, you know, you've heard me say it before. People statistically spend more time planning their vacations than they worry about planning their estate, their retirement, their this, their that. You just fill in the blank. Because guess what? It's fun. It's fun to plan that vacation. It's fun to plan that fishing trip. It's fun to do that. It's not any fun to sit down and do a budget. It's no fun to sit down and check your beneficiary forms. There's no fun to that. So just you have to force yourself to do it. And that's why I think sometimes working with professionals, financial professionals, lawyers, accountants, financial guys like me, it sort of forces you that on that annual review or however often you meet with them, that you just take a good, serious look at this stuff and keep it fresh. All right. Hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Hot Rod Holloway is going to join us. We're going to talk about the markets, the interest rates, inflation, housing starts, demographics, and more. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Man, I just hope you enjoyed the show. We talked about leaving an income inheritance. I love the idea. I've brought it up to people. We've done it for people. I have two current situations where the person has passed away, and once where the income continued on to the kids. I had another situation where we used a trust to pay an income stream to then pay for a life insurance policy. And then when the person passes away, the life insurance policy goes to the kids tax-free, and the income from the income inheritance continues for their lifetime. So, you know, that's kind of a double whammy, best of both worlds. But anyway, we're going to move on from that. On the phone now is Hot Rod Holloway, of course, the equity portfolio manager over at CFCI. And, Rod, I know, man, the markets are wild. In fact, you were talking with me this morning, I believe, about how you're putting some money to work because, you know what, you got to get it in if you're going to be in the game, right?
Yeah, most certainly. We talked about the fact of all of the short-term signals tell us that the market is due a short correction. But at the same time, everybody is waiting for that correction to be a buyer. So the problem is if you sit back and you wait for a 5% correction and you never get it, then you're always sitting on the sidelines waiting. So once you kind of start putting the math to it and you look at it and say, okay, I've got some cash build up here. What kind of performance do I get by trying to wait for this short-term correction? And then when you really look at the fact that the equity money should be long-term dollars and you mm-hmm. start looking out over 10, 15, 20 years, you really didn't have a meaningful impact on your overall return because you waited for a 3 to 5% pullback in that given year for some of your money. Same really being said from the standpoint of even if it's a brand new client with a lump sum of dollars that comes in and they're 100% cash and getting in, more than likely they didn't pick you as their new advisor expecting that you were going to effectively time the market, so you're better off getting that money in. Now, of course, if people are nervous, if they look at it and they think we're somewhat near a short-term top, although I preach all the time, don't try and time short-term market fluctuations. But if they just don't feel comfortable going 100% in because of where we're at, then there's nothing wrong with dollar cost averaging and saying, okay, hey, I'm going to put some in this month and I'll put some in next month. And then the following month, I'll put the rest of it in if we don't end up getting that correction. Of course, if the correction comes along, you can say, hey, dump the rest of those dollars in. Let's get it invested. But understand, if these equity dollars are truly long-term money, 10, 15, 20 years, then trying to time a short pullback in a short-term correction in a longer-term bull market really probably doesn't do much for you in the long haul.
Rod, I was just with one of our clients this morning, and they were nervous, and we're going to meet with another one today that's nervous about where things are. And I talked to them about, okay, listen, we have three accounts set up. We have one account which is highly liquid, easy to get to. We call that your now money. It's not really invested in anything, pretty much in cash. We then have your soon money, which is money that you're going to need sooner than later. It's money that we're going to use for your income that you're taking out, your $2,000 a month. We're going to use that over the next 10 years. Now, in this person's case, we had a bunch of fixed income producing income, interest of about $9,000 a year. And then we had another vehicle that we were going to draw down on an annual basis over 10 years to produce the other $11,000 a year to give her – I'm sorry, the other money to give her $2,000 or $22,000, $24,000 a year. And she was nervous about that later bucket, the money where you've invested it all in individual securities. It had made a ton of money here, right, in the last month and a half or 2 months. And finally got her to understand that even if the market goes down short term, you're good. You're good for the next 10, 12 years before you're going to need to touch that later money. And I think that's what you were describing right there, that if you have money invested in the market that you're going to need sooner than later, it's probably not invested in the right place.
Yeah, that's exactly right. When you look historically on 10-year windows of the S&P 500 market historically, I think you've got two 10-year time periods in which you were basically flat. Of course, the most recent one, 2000 to 2010, the other one was much longer ago, but basically flat. So you didn't lose a bunch of money if you sat there for 10 years. Now, of course, you didn't get anywhere, and that's not good performance, that if you wait 10 years on your long-term money and you get zero return out of it, but you didn't lose anything. But if you extend that horizon to a 15-year time horizon, there's no 15-year period in S&P 500 that you didn't have a positive return. Now, once again, some of those positive returns are minimal. You didn't make a lot of money, but still, what it tells you is that time is on your side with the equity, and if it's truly long-term money, typically you do come out ahead after that 10, 15, 20-year time period.
Let's talk interest rates. Of course, the Fed's been talking. They're going to meet, and they're maybe or maybe not going to raise rates in March. The market seems to just be heck with that. We don't care about that. And I think you told me in one of our meetings that the market seems to have moved from being Fed-driven to earnings-driven. Talk about that.
Yeah, most certainly has. I think the market
has accepted. Which is a big relief, by the way, finally, right?
Oh, yeah, most definitely, because it's extremely hard to look at an individual stock, read their quarterly report, and then go back and try and assess what the Fed's going to do to the market and how it impacts the stock. What you'd much prefer to do is look at the fundamentals of the companies and say, hey, did they maintain their margins? Did they grow their sales? What's the return on equity look like? What's the price to earnings growth measure? You know, those types of things is what you really want to be analyzing to determine what you want to buy, not guessing at what the next move for the Fed is. So there's no doubt that's a positive, that we are turning more into evaluating the earnings cycle and the fundamentals of individual companies as well as the economy. The market seems to think, hey, we're going to have 2 to 3. I think if you did one in March, it would catch the market a little bit off guard. But really, what's the difference between 25 basis points in March versus June, which the market seems a little more set on that June is probably that first move? So I don't think either one has a major disruption to the market, whether it's March or June. And not only myself, you, Eric Giesler, fixed income guy, we've been saying for multiple years, if the Fed starts moving up interest rates, it's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Right.
It means that the economy is doing well, improving, and can stand on its own 2 feet and doesn't need support from the Fed.
So, Rod, let's talk about the market. Let's talk about the economy, because we are seeing, you know, GDP numbers that have been reported that are okay. We finally saw some inflation come into the market where it made a four-year average of 2.5%. Still not a lot of inflation, but that's a good thing. We have some inflation. But the bond market, who I've always thought is the best indicator of where the economy is more expected to grow and go, is telling us kind of one thing, because rates are back down again, which means that the growth expectations, inflation expectations are somewhat tepid, but yet the market's on a tear. So, you know, that's kind of telling us two things. The market's saying economy great, fundamentals good, and the bond market's saying, wait a second, we're not so sure. We may want to tap the brakes here a little bit.
Yeah, and that partially goes back to what we had already talked a little bit about trying to time the market. So if you're looking for indicators to tell you when to jump into equities and when to jump out, you're getting mixed signals right now and you don't know. So that's where setting the allocation for where you're at and what your goals are makes the most sense. Now, the market itself, you know, where we're, there's enthusiasm. There is a lot of positivity out there regarding potential fiscal stimulus to the economy, be it a reduction in regulations, be it a reduction in corporate and personal taxes, be it a massive infrastructure bill, whatever it is, right now everybody is very positive and feels as though in some way, shape, or form we're going to see things done in all of those areas, which continues to push the market each and every day. I agree right now, short term, we're a little bit ahead of ourselves because we don't know what those end numbers are. We also don't know how strong this earnings growth that we just started in the third quarter of 2016 really is going to be, especially without those things coming through. Once we know what the new tax rate is, we can do a better job of calculating the benefit to earnings when we know that. We don't know that. All of those things are guesses, but it has most definitely created plenty of enthusiasm and a lot of excitement in the business community. And that's not just with the investors. That's also with the CEOs. When you hear all of them coming out of their meetings at the White House with the current administration, they're all coming out and sounding very positive that, hey, they're listening to us. They're listening to what we want to say, and they are very pro-growth, and they want to help us grow our business, be more competitive globally, and have a fairer playing field. So right now, everybody feels really good about things that's driving the market.
Rod Holloway is my guest. Of course, you'll hear him on Glass in the Morning on Mondays and Fridays, and I kind of pinch hit in the middle of the week. So, Rod, appreciate it very much. I'll catch you in the morning. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Dave. You have a wonderful show, and talk to you later.
All right, see ya. We're going to take a quick break. We come back. We only have a couple minutes to wrap up the big show preview what's coming up next week. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Just a minute or so left in the program. Next week's show, Doug Hughes will be pinch hitting for me. He'll also have Ron on for at least a segment. I'm going to take my son, and after a long wrestling season and so-so grades, I'm going to take him fishing. We're going to head down to New Orleans and fish for redfish down in the marshes of Louisiana. So pretty darn excited about that. And then what? We'll be coming up on spring break pretty soon. We'll be replaying the Power of Zero show when David McKnight was on with me. And then backing that up, Mary Beth Franklin with Investment News, formerly with Kiplinger. She'll be on. Tom Bunger will be on to talk estate planning. It's going to be a fabulous February and a fantastic March on the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. So hope everyone has a great weekend. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.